This episode is brought to you by OmniFocus.guru, a seminar hosted by yours truly, free for the Rad Awakenings community. It's that time of the year where we come out guns a-blazing with resolutions, habits, and intentions. Yet most of them fall flat, especially in the category of things that are important but not urgent. This could include side projects, learning goals, or health and fitness. The challenge is that a lack of a hard deadline makes following through almost impossible. One tool that's helped me over the past decade is a piece of software called OmniFocus. OmniFocus lets you implement David Allen's Getting Things Done philosophy, or GTD. I get asked all the time how I use it, so I'm going to host a free webinar to share my approach. It's totally free. Sign up at OmniFocus.guru. That's OmniFocus.guru. See you there. Welcome to the Rad Awakenings podcast. I'm Kay He. When was the last time you became aware of something deep, provocative, and uncomfortable? In these moments, we level up in our work, our creativity, and most importantly, in our own heads. Each episode, our guests will describe their Rad Awakenings. The conversations are real, raw, and will share in both struggle and joy. At 22 years old, Mike Lewis had life figured out. He had gotten a hard-to-come-by job at the prestigious venture firm Bain Capital and was making his way up the ranks, all while having fun. But there was a little nagging voice reminding him of a childhood dream, to play professional squash, a sport that is unique because even for the best players, it's hard to make a living. But Mike had to make the jump, and this episode is a playbook of sorts for chasing your dreams. The media will tell you sexy stories about people who left it all, but these stories hide the behind-the-scenes work, the planning, safety nets, and ways in which you can practice. And then somehow, someway, with the right amount of persistence and reflection, luck will seem to find you and take you on totally unexpected adventures. This conversation mirrors many of my own post-Wall Street learnings, and I'm excited to share my conversation with Mike Lewis. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Rad Awakenings podcast. Today's guest is my friend, Mike Lewis. How's it going, Mike?
It's going great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I wanted to start. Tell us a little bit about where you're from, where you grew up.
Yeah, so I am actually back in my hometown of Santa Barbara right now as we speak. I wasn't born here. I was born where you're at, actually, in New York. I was the youngest of six kids. Folks are from New York. Mom's from Purchase. Dad's from Long Island. Actually, their parents were both from New York, first-generation immigrants, or I guess the kids of first-generation immigrants. And we moved to Tennessee and then out to Santa Barbara. I spent about 10 years in Tennessee from middle school era, I would say kindergarten through sixth grade for me. And then right around the time of 13, moved out to the beautiful beaches of Southern California and have absolutely loved it since then. It's been terrific. And that's what I call home.
Why did you guys move around so much?
You know, it's interesting, actually. I was talking to my mom about this last night. She actually took the reins of my own podcast show and interviewed me. And I think that it was opportunity and it was adventure. And I think it was this, you know, a memory in the making in some ways. I think my family and my parents felt that there was greater things for the kids to explore in different cities outside of just New York City. And not that New York wasn't great, but they thought, especially for having a childhood, there might be something to be said for having some more space and having a more neighborhood feel. And then, funny enough, after we moved to Nashville and grew up there, my oldest sibling, my only brother, there's four girls in between us, he had finished school at Vanderbilt, had chased his dream out west to be a sports writer, was living in San Diego, and my dad had visited Santa Barbara at one point years earlier. So when my mom and dad went to visit him, my dad took my mom up to Santa Barbara. They fell in love with Santa Barbara and thought, geez, let's bring the kids out here. We did a family trip, which we were really lucky to get to do. And then a couple things came up for my dad's job where he could actually work from that city. And so I think in the span of a year and a half, 18, 24 months, we were out in Santa Barbara. And so we've always just, I think, had that sort of adventure sense. And I really credit my parents for breeding that within all of us through those moves.
And so fast forward us a bit to you go to Dartmouth undergrad. What did you end up studying?
I've yet to use my major in any practical way, but I studied political science. I think it's a cool thing to do, right? Like, you know, you got to just do something totally different than what you study or else you're not cool. And I'm obviously super cool, as you can tell. So, no, I got there and I was like, I want to take as many different courses as you can. And again, I went from a big public high school where I hadn't seen that type of rigor in a classroom and the type of diversity and course load and selection and majors. And so I took a little bit of everything, but I ultimately landed on government with a focus on the American political system, and then a minor in environmental studies, and then a bunch of random courses in between, from Japanese culture to women and gender studies to geography, creative writing, I think, was in there, just a little bit of everything.
And so the on-campus recruiting starts like junior-ish year, and somehow this kind of mishmash of academic coursework lands you in the world of venture capital. How the hell did that happen?
Even to back up a little bit, I had always been entrepreneurial. I remember having an eBay reselling business in my parents' basement where I would take, you know, old clothes and resell them at a markup and get a great commission for not only my mom, but then her friends in the neighborhood. In junior high, or sorry, later in high school, I started a internet education company that really was version 0.1 of what you see today in collaborative online learning and academic social homeworking and study prep areas and study spaces. But we had a lot to learn. It was an early start to the internet world and to being an entrepreneur. We raised some money. It ultimately didn't work out and wasn't a success story by any means, but it got me really hooked on that idea of taking ideas, the idea of taking ideas and trying to make them realities. And how do you scale a company? How do you turn a dream into a business? Things like that. And so I actually interned for a few years, well, 1 year, as a rising senior at Goldman Sachs in New York. And as you know from the Wall Street world you came from, it's a totally different ballgame than entrepreneurship. And not say it's a bad ballgame, it's just very different. Much more corporate, macro. You're in many ways on the services side. You're supporting and advising, but you're not necessarily building companies. And so I was planning to go back to Goldman. I was lucky enough to have an offer to go back. And then this thing came out on our career services bulletin from a venture capital firm called Bain Capital Ventures. It was part of Bain Capital. And everything made sense to me then. It was like, oh my gosh, I can go work for a venture firm that's job is literally to go find cool people with great ideas and help them build businesses around it. So it just felt like the perfect mesh of my interests and also still a corporate job that checks the box, which, as we all know, matters to us.
And many of our listeners are aspiring to get into the VC game. But just to put some context on it for those who are less familiar, it's pretty rare to go from undergrad to a VC firm, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was so much me being a smart guy as me being in the right place, right time. And obviously had the grades, but they took two folks, myself and another gentleman who's still a friend of mine today, as their analyst class. So it was different than a law firm that might take 50 new associates or something like that, or investment banking where you get a class of 100. But I was, you know, one of the two and really truly felt lucky. I felt like I won the lottery. I got to skip a lot of steps, which was, you know, a blessing for sure for me.
Yeah. And Bain is also, it's in the OG crew of VC firms. Like, it's the real deal for our listeners who aren't familiar. So,
well, really quick story about that. So this is the year 2011 in the fall. And if you remember, Mitt Romney was steaming ahead to charge up against Barack Obama in Obama's reelection campaign for the 2012 presidential race. So I joined right as everything was getting heated, and Bain Capital was actually started by Mitt Romney. So it was just a funny place to be. And I remember in orientation sitting next to a guy who, you know, and I always thought, well, it's not like Mitt's still involved with the firm, and he wasn't obviously in the day-to-day, but there was a lot of different random connections. And I remember the guy next to me during orientation was like, oh, do you want to come to brunch next week? Do you want to come, you know, to a brunch for my friend Tag? And we went to brunch, and it was a brunch with Tag Romney, Mitt's son, and all of his friends. And I was like, wow, what a different world than what I grew up from in Santa Barbara.
Wow. And to also rewind to a gentler time in life, that was when Binders Full of Women was the worst political statement, like snafu one could make. Can you imagine that?
That's an exact... What a time capsule.
Yeah, I know. Seriously. Are you analyzing startups for investment while you're at Bain?
Yeah, it was one of those things where they didn't give you a whole lot of instruction by the book. It was more learn on the go. It was one of those jobs you just got better at as you analyzed more companies and met more entrepreneurs. So I got a bunch of business cards, an email address, all the resources of Bain Capital, which was incredible asset in every way. They had a great brand name, 60-something billion of assets under management. They knew everyone. I had something behind me now that would allow people to pick up the phone and take my call. And my memo was to go get really interesting companies on the line and understand their business model. And if they fit, see if we can pitch them on taking our investment instead of some other venture firms. And while that sounds easy enough, it was truly a needle in a haystack. You would analyze thousands of companies a year for maybe two investments.
So 21-year-old Mike is roaming around the Northeast and Boston trying to find cool tech companies to invest in with Bain's balance sheet or Bain's funds, basically.
Yeah, I think I was 22 and I felt like the world was, you know, giving me the biggest gift in the world. And it truly was. I felt like I was given this gift. Like I said, I'm sure many folks listening can relate. On paper, everything was like exactly how it should be. And I think it was beyond my parents' wildest dreams, my own. It felt like I had kind of done it. And then, you know, I got lucky on a few different things and got to do good work, and we just were rolling.
Probably also making good money for a 22-year-old.
Yeah, for sure. And money was never for me the driving force, but it was kind of like, wow, I get paid to do this. It was just fun. I really thought it was fun.
Okay, so I'm going to replay some of the words you've used. You've used the lottery, you used fun, you know, a dream come true. And then to take from your language, from your book, what is it? The little voice starts to kick in?
Yeah, what I call listening to the little voice in your head.
What was the little voice in your head saying to 22, 23-year-old Mike?
Well, it's funny. I think it started actually 10 years earlier. So I was 23 at the time, and when I was 13... and living in, I guess it was Santa Barbara right after moving, we had joined a health club that I'm actually going to go to later today, Santa Barbara Athletic Club. Shout out to all the SBAC folks. We had a booming squash community there. I kind of say that tongue in cheek, but we had a loyal crew of 20, 50 folks who played squash. And it was the only courts within 100 miles that were like a dedicated squash community, 100 miles-ish, plus or minus some miles. But it was where I went every day after school, and I loved it. And at that point, I said, I'm going to be a pro squash player. Because we had a pro tournament coming through town once a year, and our family would sign up to host a player, because in the pro squash world, surprise, surprise, you're not making a whole lot of dough. And so to defray the cost of travel, the tournament organizers would do what I just mentioned. They would offer up families' homes who are connected to the community or squash or the club to players. And so I signed our parents up to host a player named Sean Delier. We end up getting along well over dinner one night at the table. He says, you know, you should go do what I'm doing. And he talked about playing squash on mountains in Brazil and towns like ours in California and cities along the Pacific. And I just felt like at some point I'm going to do that. And it was a crazy idea. And it was a voice in my head that was planted. And over time, you know, we glossed over a lot of the not pretty stuff, but I tried and failed for like 8 years with squash. I got better and better slowly, war of attrition in some degree, and then end up getting recruited to play at Dartmouth, lightly recruited, I would say, but kind of blew out my expectations when I got there, was super pumped to be on a team. And then I finish and get to Bain, and it's like, well, shoot, here I am doing this job I like, but this voice in my head wouldn't go away. So
I'm going to rewind you that. So what was it specifically about squash that sucked you in?
I think I was attracted to the independent nature of it. Not only is it an individual sport, but I think I was one of five kids playing west of Greenwich, Connecticut. And so I loved the sport because it was on me to get better. It was very clear and very objective whether I was good or improving. If I did well and was better, you know, better than the other player, I would win the match. If not, I would lose. And that put the onus on me to improve and to figure out, almost in an entrepreneurial way, how to get better. And then number two, because there was no one around that was my age competitive, you know, on the junior circuit, I was really fortunate that my dad helped support me, but you really had to kind of get creative. And so we would play Midwestern Junior Championships against the three other kids from the Midwest and West Coast of the country. I would go to Portland for a tournament. I would kind of see this world that was growing because I was following my nose with the sport. And for me, that was what squash gave me, was this outlet, this excuse to get out of my bubble. And then over time, as I got better, it was like, geez, I could do this on a bigger scale by playing pro squash.
Wow. I want to interject because I had a brief flirtation with squash. I played not even recreationally, but probably a couple times a month for maybe 2 or 3 years in my mid-20s. And I've played recreationally a lot of sports. It's one of the hardest freaking sports out there. And for our listeners, it's like the ball totally F's with you because it's like a hacky sack. It looks super bouncy, but as soon as it hits the ground, it bounces like 1 inch off the ground. And then there's all this strategy of bouncing stuff off the walls and like cornering people. And it's like the most intense start-stop sport. And again, in your mid-20s, that's when you start to feel start-stop sports not really working out for your aging joints and muscles. So mad respect on, I think, you know, I would always say squash was the second hardest sport that I'd ever played behind boxing. And they were very close in terms of the physical intensity.
Well, I think that boxing is probably harder because you're getting hit.
Yeah. But in terms of the intensity of the kind of cardiovascular, it's not even cardiovascular, it's lactic and everything.
All of that, yeah.
And you have to use a ton of strategy. It's like almost playing chess in that little room.
It feels like that in a lot of ways, is that you're not necessarily, it's interesting, if you know racquetball, some people are like, oh, it's like racquetball. It is and it isn't. It's the same court, similar, close enough. It's the somewhat similar rules. You're hitting it against a wall. But in racquetball, as you get better, the points are shorter. Unfortunately, in squash, the better you get, the longer the rallies are. And so you're not just thinking, I'm going to hit this shot to beat my opponent right now. You're actually thinking, I'm going to hit this shot to move him to the front. Then he's going to hit a lob to my backhand. Then I'm going to hit it straight back. Then he's going to hit a sidewall, front wall boast, which is what that's called. Then I'm going to hit a drop. Then he'll run up and barely get the drop. And at that point, I'll have him out of position. So you're thinking like 8 shots ahead, but then all the while you're lunging, hunching, grunting, and, you know, tumbling over yourself to keep up. So yeah, it's brutal, but it's fun.
Talking and listening to your story has like inspired me to get back onto a squash court.
Oh, I love it.
But okay, so you're recruited to play at Dartmouth. Is there a shot at going pro after college or while in college?
No. First of all, the pro squash tour is like the ugly stepsister to the pro tennis tour. The pro tennis tour you can actually make a living off of. In squash, if you're not in the top 100, but really in the top 20 or 50, it's really hard. And it's hard because there's not a lot of television with squash. You probably haven't seen it on TV lately or on ESPN 1 through 8. I think that for me, the idea was really just this life adventure. And to be honest, in America, I think unfortunately it's changing, but a lot of players grow up saying, I want to go to X school, like a good college, and I think I can get recruited by playing squash, which is, I guess, fine, but that often leads to them saying, okay, I'm in school, I'll be on the team, but this is it. And so most people kind of, that's where it ends. Not saying that I was this unique person, because there's a lot of guys who do it, but relative to the rest of the world, there are very few Americans that go play pro squash. And it's really, really hard. And you feel kind of like, my parents got me to this point where I got to go to college, and for me, had a job lined up after. Why in the world would you put that on the line to go make literally, you know, $30 in a tournament and sleep in a bunk bed underneath the courts?
So you're basically on the pro squash tour, you're paying for the right to be on it, like dipping into your saving if you're not in those top 20 or elite players.
Yeah, the tournaments I were in were like single A, double A. It was $5,000, 5Ks. They call them 5Ks. They were satellite tournaments that weren't necessarily low level in terms of quality. The play was good. It was just that it was a really tough spot because you really were, unless you had sponsorships, you were losing money at every tournament and maybe breaking even. But what you had there was such an interesting mix of people because you had people that were on the way up. You know, I played 17-year-old Egyptians who became top players and guys who were on the way down, you know, 30-something-year-olds who were giving it one last shot. So it was just an interesting mix.
So you're sitting in your corner office at Bain and listening to the little voice. So what's the voice saying to you as a 23-year-old?
I think what it said was, I remember a friend of mine, Emily Bross, shout out to Emily, gave me this map of the world. And it was from Doctors Without Borders, that a nonprofit that goes around the world doing amazing medical care in rural and impoverished communities. Anyway, she had given it to me, and I had posted it along my wall, this map. And I also had a quote along my computer screen. I actually pasted it next to my computer screen from Jeff Bezos during the Princeton commencement of 2010. And he said something at the end to the effect of, when you're 80 years old and you look back on your life, the things that will be most powerful to you will be the stories that you've created and the choices you've made that lead to those stories. Go make yourself a great story. And I just knew at that point, with that quote and with this map of the world, that every year would go by and I would be wondering, could I be over in New Zealand playing, yes, a 5K and living in a basement, but actually doing it? Could I be there? And the answer was, yeah, I could be, but for some reason I'm not.
You were creating that story, like you had the dream job, you could literally sit in that seat, I'm sure you're really talented at it, and do that and crush it for 25 straight years. What was unappealing about that story?
I didn't look in that way. I stepped back and I was like, what is more terrifying, doing this crazy jump, taking a risk, playing pro squash, or not playing? And no matter how good things were and how comfortable and certain my life would be, sitting in the back of my head for the next 20 to 30 years while I worked and crushed it, if I was lucky to do all that stuff, would be this question that would linger. And years would go into decades, and decades would become my life story. And going back to that quote from Jeff Bezos, it was like, gosh, that is terrifying. So as scary as it was to go try something like this dream out, more terrifying was to not do anything. And yes, maybe have a nice career, but always wonder what could have been.
Yeah. I'll add, when I did my jump, and mine was not as glamorous as jumping onto a professional sporting tour, but people would always say, wow, okay, that's so risky what you're doing, you know, leaving this comfortable trajectory and income. And I would say to them, no, the riskier thing is never having known what could have been. And having that unanswered question in my head for the rest of my life. Like, that sounded way riskier to me.
Yeah, I think that what it comes down to is, like, what do you want your, and not to be morbid, but what do you want your obituary to read? And I think when you looked down the barrel of your choices and, like, what you were going to do, even if you went back to finance, for me it was like, you know, the highest job was what you had, not to pump you up, but you could be a managing director at, you know, Bain Capital, like that's a big deal. I was like, well, pretend I'm writing my biography, you know, less morbid, in like 20 years or 30 years. You know, we're living longer these days. Careers are long. I could go play pro squash. I could fumble around. I could maybe, you know, start a community and a platform. We had to write this book, like all these things that I actually didn't think would happen at the time that are now fortunately getting to happen. But I could do all that and then come back and have just a cool story of things that happened before I became a partner, you know, or whatever that is. And so it's kind of like you got to step back and, you know, look at the forest from the trees and look at the whole piece of work rather than just a day at a time or a year in a glimpse, you know, in a glimpse, because that's what we live for. And I would be remiss not to mention that my buddy next to me at work, when I was thinking through all this, his name's Corey Griffin. Corey was just a legendary guy. He knew everyone in Boston, played hockey at BC, started the Ice Bucket Challenge soon after I left to go on the tour, for his friend who had ALS, Pete Frades. Corey was with me the night I remember getting a spark for this idea that would become When to Jump, which was, I was desperate to find stories that would reinforce that hey, this is worth doing, this is a risk worth taking. And I had Googled when to chase dreams and nothing good came up. And by that, I mean, you see Instagram posts and LinkedIn messages and Facebook news feeds, and all of it looks like the pretty glossed over filtered ending point of chasing your dream, but no one was talking about what it actually would look like. And at that point, I just needed someone to be like, hey, it's going to be crappy and it's going to be hard and there are going to be tough times, but it's going to be worth it. And I got to a woman who had left finance, was at Lehman Brothers, left at the height of Lehman. Actually, she would tell the story better, but something to the effect of, like, she was putting in her notice and her boss said, well, we're always going to be here and you don't know what's going to come out next for you, or something like that. You'd have to quote her. That wasn't exactly probably the right story, but something to that effect. And I got her on the phone, and I remember that night with Corey sitting in my office. It was January of 2013, and I'd just spoken to her, and I cold called her. And she had told me not how to be a cyclist or how to be an Olympian, which is what she became when she left Lehman. She made the cycling tour representing the U.S. in Rio and in London before that. But what she said was, here is what is going to be hard. Here are the tough conversations. Here's the internal struggles that I had. And when I hung up with her, I sketched a cover page to a book that I really wanted for myself. I wanted that story to be pasted with other stories, to be put together in something physical that I could say to my parents or others, here is something that I feel gives me permission to go chase a dream. Here's the reality, the what I call the 10,000 unsexy steps of doing what you love. And this person did it and she survived. She's able to even talk about it. And this guy did it too. And oh, this person did it too. And they're all different, but they came together to prove a point that you can chase your dreams. And Corey, you know, really was a believer in big ideas and going to chase them. And he kept me honest. I pinned that cover page to my wall next to the map of the world and the quote from Bezos for the next year and a half. And I always told him I'd make that book and really create a community that the book would be a calling card for, that a book could anchor, that I also called When to Jump. And so sadly, when I ended up going to play the tour and all that, you know, Corey passed away in an accident a few months in, and that's what kind of left me pushing on to a next jump that would be in his honor and dedication.
Wow. Do you think that this pursuing dreams philosophy, people push back on me when I tell the story? They're like, well, you know, you are well educated, you had savings. You know, there's a lot of kind of, you're in a unique situation to do this because of X. Do you get that pushback when you tell the, you know, because there is, I mean, you and I would be the first to acknowledge that we are extremely privileged. But did you find people pushing back against that, like, pursue your dreams blindly mantra?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, we can talk about the book itself later, but the book is, I believe, as this airs, will be right out. We're recording it, you know, a week before, but I think the book will be in its first week of release. And in the very beginning, I think I go to great pains to say, listen, my situation was very lucky and unique to me. I had no kids, no mortgage. I'd saved some money, all that stuff. I don't skirt that subject. It's really important to acknowledge the realities. For some folks listening, you may be burdened with some debt that you're working to pay off. You may have your third child on the way. You might have just bought a house. All those things probably mean it's not your time to jump. But, and there's a big but, I believe that you're in life either taking a jump or you're preparing for your next jump. So that doesn't mean you can't start listening to your little voice. And in the book itself, I actually have this framework I developed from all the research I did. We have 44 stories from all different walks of life. They're organized through those four phases. So we talked about listen to the little voice. We also can talk about the next one, make a plan. And that's the part people miss. And I think if you're not jumping, like I said, you can be thinking about jumping, and that's where you can be. And I don't think anyone is too busy and too overburdened to take teeny tiny little baby steps towards planning their jump. And that's what I think people tend to miss.
Tell us about the plan that you started to put forth.
Well, I broke it down into three pieces. One, I knew there was going to be financial planning. Like there was no nest egg I was counting on. I needed to come up with this money myself. Yes, my job was nicely paying, but I was in it for like 2 years. It wasn't exactly like 30. And then on the other side was what I called safety net sewing. And this is where I think this goes a little counterintuitive to, you know, what you see on social media, pop culture, Instagram, etc., is that I was scared out of my mind that I'd never have a job again, that I would go play squash. Maybe it'd be good, maybe not, but I'd come back without a job. And so I went to very great lengths to protect what I believed was a really solid foundation. So I would take people out to coffee. I would work extra hard on projects. I would ask for extra homework at work. I would take on stuff to really make sure that I did my job well. I double checked the box of being a good investor at Bain Capital before I thought of leaving. And then lastly, I call it, you know, pre-jump practice. This also, I think, gets lost a little bit. You know, you should do as much as you can of the thing you want to go do before you go do it. Not to say you should always balance two worlds, but there's a lot you can do on the side before you jump. And for me, it was eating like a pro, training like a pro, working out nights and weekends at night, taking a train to New York, playing in a tournament, getting on a flight back the next morning, being at the desk before the office hours open, joining the Pro Tour part-time for nearly a year before leaving. Like, all of these little things that, you know, on their own were hobbies, but put together a really nice ramp up to my jump. So I think those are the three things that I go into way more detail in on the book, is the financial planning, the safety net sewing, and the pre-jump practice.
Did you have, like, I could do this for 6 months, you know, did you kind of forecast your cash flows roughly and basically build up a safety net, a financial net to match those expected spendings?
Yeah, I basically was like, hey, okay, and I didn't mention this earlier, I pitched sponsors. I gave people the opportunity to buy logo space on my jersey. And, you know, it wasn't even like a legit trade. I mean, they knew what they were getting into, but I used Bain Capital templates. I was a PowerPoint whiz, if I must say so. And I put over those logos of Bain, I put my own squash logos, and I made a pitch. And I would go out and pitch sponsors, like local business owners and friends, and was like, hey, your logo can be around the world, you know, for, what is it, 2-3 months. I think I was giving myself 3 months at a minimum. And I got enough money to, like, I think cover those first 3 months. And then I was like, I'm going to go for 1 month in New Zealand to start, because those are where the smallest tournaments I could get into would be hosted. And a funny side note to that, I actually was on the wait list for all those tournaments. So I quit my job and then got an email from this friendly fellow down in New Zealand who was a tournament organizer. And he kind of said, hey, mate, you know, I see you're on the wait list and I just want to make sure, you really want to come down for this? You know, you're not actually in the tournament yet. And I said, buddy, I just quit my job. I'm packing up my life. Please let me just get down there and stay on the wait list. So I ended up taking that jump, but crucially, I had some friends from, you know, a former assistant coach at Dartmouth was down there, and other players going to the tournaments where I thought I could stay with others for the first few weeks. And so I pitched up enough kind of savings to get, I think, 3 months in, but I really had planned for 1 month with others. And then I thought I'd, you know, go into a hotel and, you know, get a long-term apartment or something. I didn't really know what was going to happen, but I did save up for enough for that first part.
Got it. Yeah, about the plan, I think it is the unsexy stuff. People look at me when I left and they're like, why didn't you start a company while you were, because I initially thought I was going to be an entrepreneur, like a tech entrepreneur. Like, why didn't you start a company while you were still working and you had health insurance and income? And I was like, dude, I tried. I would wake up at 4 a.m. and make hypothetical decks, like very similar stuff to you. I would host secret events, networking events, and all that. And I had the little voice was saying to me is, and probably like you, I was working 12, 14 hour days for my corporate job. So I was doing it on the edges of that 14 hour day. You know, I was just doing stuff, and a lot of these things congealed to where they are now. But some of them, it's more just like, just start. And I think this is one that I want to just share with our listeners, is because now what I see people do is they want to jump, but then all they do is read blog posts about jumping. And it's like, just start the smallest thing, a website, a blog, a t-shirt company, go sell a sponsorship on your squash jersey. It's like that, you know, there's a lot of talk about hustle, but I feel like there's a lot less action when it comes to the actual art of hustling.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It can be tantalizing and compelling and just far too easy to get into the mode of talking about taking a jump. And it's very sexy cocktail conversation and water cooler talk, but unfortunately, that's not going to get you there.
What were you most afraid of as you jumped?
Well, the meta fear was the unknown. So I think it was like being, oh my God, what's coming next? So when you plan a jump, I should note this, you know, you can only know so much. You're never going to know some portion of what's happening next. And that's the stuff that nearly kept me from leaving. Ultimately, and this is a huge point of, I think, taking a jump, the best pieces, truly the people I met, the places I went, I 1 month turned into 3 months, turned into nearly 2 years, around 50 countries, 200,000 miles, this amazing experience that almost all of which I couldn't have planned. And so all of the good came from that unknown that nearly kept me from jumping. If you were to draw a Venn diagram, it was literally, you know, one circle. The fear of the unknown and the unknown that was great were the same thing. And so that nearly kept me from going. And then the unknown of, will I ever get a job again? And I think that proved to be silly too, because I think I was far more interesting on the other end of it than I was before.
Yeah, because I was thinking about your jump, and even if you had the most success possible on the tour, it still wouldn't have been particularly financially rewarding. Like, you'd still have to come back and do something. It's not like you could have become LeBron James. Your sport didn't allow that, or didn't, it wasn't even in the realm of possibility. And so was there a thought that, like, I'm going to have to re-enter the workforce, and I'm using massive air quotes as I say that. Like, how did you see it playing out after you were done playing squash?
I really didn't know. I kind of thought maybe grad school. I actually thought if I stayed in venture capital, one of the things they always push is, and they as being bosses and partners, is go get operating experience, which means that's code for go work in a company. So I kind of thought, if I'm going to go do that, this is just a really nice sandwich in between. And who cares if it's 2 months or 6 months, I'm going to go do something else. Because I still think I could be a kick butt investor someday in a venture capital firm, but I wanted to do other things first. And so I was ready to go take that jump into something else. And this would be kind of a bookmark. And then afterwards, I figured I'd just interview for companies and in cool kind of organizations that were doing really neat work. And I thought I would go for it. I actually followed that plan. I came back and stayed on my buddy's couch in San Francisco and started interviewing. And yet, like I said, having Corey pass and really understanding kind of his legacy and what I wanted to go forward, you know, I made it a point to say, before I get a job, just try to get this When to Jump concept off the ground. Yeah, I bought whentojump.com, which was miraculously still available. I started collecting stories while I was traveling. I just didn't want to be a joker where I was back to the workforce, back on a 9-to-5, and had nothing to show for this project, and just talking about the other thing I wanted to do. It almost felt like another version of the squash thing. I didn't want to be looking around being like, oh, I wonder if I could have written a book or if I could have started a community around this. I had a really clear vision where we'd have, you know, festivals of people having good food and drinks and beers and tasty treats and talking together around jumps they want to make, and a electrician helping a teacher and a librarian helping a banker and the banker helping an accountant. Everyone kind of getting together in a real authentic and normal way with media and books and other things to surround ourselves with. And so when I came back, I just went all in to try to get that off the ground. I really busted my butt to just have a blog out, push these stories I had gotten to. I'm sure many of your listeners know Michael Lewis, the Wall Street author who has written Liar's Poker and Moneyball. And he took a chance to give me 30 minutes of his time for one of the case studies that's now in the book. But he, you know, a lot of everyday people, the former second baseman for the Cubs, who's now a grad student at NYU, whose jump was to go to college and leave baseball. The former bishop from the Anglican Church who left PR to go to the church. She became the first female bishop in the world for the Anglican Church. And I just wanted to get it out before I started that full-time next step. And, you know, fortunately, a lot of great things happened at once. I was approached by Book Folks. We ended up signing a book deal, had Arianna Huffington initiate a partnership with HuffPost. And these things kind of rolled up where I don't think I made it, but I had then enough to say, okay, I can anchor this next jump. I can take the next year and a half till the book comes out and get a business laid and a foundation put forth and focus on it entirely.
I want to ask you about luck or creating your own luck. But before that, you know, one of the questions that we talk about a lot on this podcast is the power of kind of uncomfortable introspection and kind of looking in to your fears, your ego, judgment, kind of the darker or more obfuscated parts of your soul, not to be dramatic, because you cannot succeed in kind of, you know, unique situations or contrarian situations if you don't self-regulate that way. Is there something in your own journey where you were kind of forced to kind of confront something about yourself that you weren't as comfortable with that was a part of this whole experience?
Yeah, well, first of all, not to pat you on the back, but I think your podcast and certainly your newsletter as well does a great job of zeroing in on these intensely human introspective moments that we have with ourselves that are really important to have. And I think you do a very good job, and Rad Reads does this as well, with just being able to tell people, hey, it's okay to take a step back, take a breath, and kind of have that internal dialogue. And I think it's really hard in our media crazy driven world and with so many distractions to stay, to take those kind of 5 seconds for yourself. So I think for me, it was just, again, one of the many nights that I had before leaving where I thought, you know, my parents put forth this life or helped put forth this life for me. My siblings supported me. If I'm going to do this, I need to really be sure that I'm going to see it through, that I'm not jumping for the wrong reasons. I think it's easy to not jump because of the social status and income and prestige of a life and a job, but it's also sexy to jump for those same reasons, and that's scary. You know, I think the introspection came from being like, is this really, am I doing this for the right reasons? And I felt very strongly that I was ultimately.
Yeah, that parent thing, the nurturing parents, did you feel any guilt about what you were doing?
I did, in the sense that I was the youngest of six. Like I said, my mom, you know, was a mother. I think it's a lot easier for her to, you know, tell her friends, hey, Mike's, you know, working in venture capital in Boston, instead of Mike's on a couch in the Pacific somewhere. And, you know, my dad had been a squash player, and I think he loved that piece of it. But for both of them, you know, they put a lot into education and getting stability for the kids. And here I was, like, taking a wrecking ball to it. So I did feel guilt. It's funny, our podcast that comes out the day of the book launch, which I believe would be the day before people hear this, but or whatever, January 9th, we have a podcast every Tuesday. And my mom actually interviewed me on it, like I mentioned earlier. And that's actually what we talked about, was like, what did it really feel like as a parent? Because I don't think any jump is alone. I think particularly if you have a spouse and kids, they're involved, but definitely your family. And that produces a lot of guilt, or at least it did for me.
And so going back to the luck question, you know, people look at, you know, you did the squash thing and now you've got a book deal and this, you know, amazing podcast with Sheryl Sandberg and, you know, guests that I'm like, maybe in 100 episodes, I'll get them. And, you know, someone's like, wow, that guy got really lucky. But maybe there's not a question in this, but I believe just from hearing what you're saying, that it is, yes, there's an element of luck. And we have won so many lotteries in our lives, and we're grateful for it. But there is this element that you put yourself out there for the luck to find you. And I think that that's what I've learned in the jump process, is when you put yourself out there and start living your truth, people are like, God damn, that person's doing it. And all these people come out of nowhere and they want you to succeed. And it's so different than Wall Street, where like you start to succeed and people are like, I want to take you down because you have what I want. And I think you did mention the details, you have kind of embodied that. You are embodying it. And my money is like, you're not going, whenever when you're done with this book, the book and the community, like, you're not going to get a desk job unless you specifically seek one out. And like, that's what you actually want to do at that point.
Yeah, I mean, totally. And you kind of nailed it on the head. The step after make a plan, which follows listen to a little voice, is let yourself be lucky. And ironically, it was another finance person, Michael Lewis, who was telling me about that. And it's exactly as you said, you know, if you put yourself in a position to bump into things, I believe I call it colliding. You'll collide with the people, opportunities, experiences that yes, you'll say, you know, wow, that was lucky, but actually is pretty intentional, and you've done that. And you first have to take those other steps to set up the pieces, but then you've got to jump. That's the whole point, is the unknown will come alive when you actually let yourself be lucky.
Beautiful, man. And so tell us all about your crazy various projects and where we can go find them.
For sure. Well, first, I appreciate you having me on and love what you're doing. And I'm honored to be part of the community here and share what we're doing. So whentojump.com has everything you could ask for on our platform. You can find our podcast there, which comes out every Tuesday. You can share your story. We love to hear from folks who have taken a jump. And jumps can be big or small. It's not necessarily one size fits all. It doesn't even have to be changing jobs. It could be changing parts of your lifestyle. You can find it all on whentojump.com. And then two things that are coming up. One is we're actually starting a learning program, an online kind of collaboration for what we call Jump Ambassadors. And we're going to open that up in February, I think on February 1, for folks who want to work on their jump with other people in a kind of a virtual environment, which I'm super stoked about. But then most important, which is most exciting, is that January 9th, the book comes out. So you can look and find When to Jump, the book, anywhere books are sold and online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc. You can also go to whentojump.com/book, and all of the buttons are right there. From what I found, everyone has someone in their life that could benefit from taking a jump. And I've worked really hard and have had an amazing team to work with at our publishing house to make this something that's timeless. You can dog-eat a page in one section of the book, take a jump, and then return to a whole different section of the book later on for your next jump. And so that's what I hope people get out of it. And if you read it and like it, shoot me a note. I'd love to hear what you think.
Awesome. And one thing from it's been 3 years since I jumped, and everything you're doing is awesome. It resonates so deeply. And I wish I had known. I wish it existed. I mean, I guess it was being created as I was jumping. But one of the greatest things that I learned in in my jump is that you're actually not alone, and there's actually this gigantic community of people who are in so many different various iterations, right? Like you did squash, and we're like 12 years apart in age. You played squash, and I thought I was going to be a startup person and ended up blogging, and look at how our paths have created. And that to the people who are contemplating jumping, know that once you do take that jump, there's so many people out there that have your back and that want to support you, and they want to see you win, because most people won't do it. And so if not, it's just like mad respect for doing it. And so what this ties to you, Mike, is that you have made it even easier for people to not find themselves alone in what is a lonely process. And that is just like, that's such important work, and I'm super grateful for it.
Well, I appreciate that. And, that was actually where When to Jump came from, was sitting in my cubicle being like, this is so, there's a sad irony to this that everyone says go chase your dreams, but then you feel so alone in doing it. So if I can help one other person feel like they've got that backbone and not feel too cheesy, we're not a kumbaya group. It's really about telling it like it is and having folks like you to help share the story and give an amazing audio voice acting, segment for us, then I think we'll be really happy and we'll have done a good job. So I appreciate it.
Awesome. Mike, this was fantastic. Thank you so much. And best of luck to you on this latest chapter.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Rad Awakenings podcast. For more information on all things Rad, including our weekly email newsletter, please visit us at radreads.co. This podcast is a labor of love and funded by the community's generosity. And if you're interested in supporting us, please join us as a patron by visiting patreon.com/radreads. And of course, leaving a 5-star review always goes a long way. Thanks again, and until next time.